This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. It's the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance. Hey, it's me, James Stacy, and this episode of Hodinkee Radio was inspired by a story that Nick, our EVP of content, recently wrote about why modding watches is so uncommon within the greater scope of the watch industry. Wanting to dig deeper into this interesting topic, I invited Nick and recent Talking Watches guest Cooper Zelnick on the show to chat about it. Cooper is the founder of Cloister Watch Co., a brand that modifies vintage watches in a manner that reimagines designs that might have been. We chat about the world of watch mods, OEM customization, the value of customization in luxury goods, and even a few wishlist modifications that we'd love to see become a reality on some of our favorite watches. Who knows? Maybe we'll change or modify your mind on the topic. Let's find out. All right, Nick, Cooper, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm really looking forward to this.
Hey, James, great to be here with you.
Thanks for having me.
Nick, I think we need to start with a little bit of background, just in case somebody hasn't read your post about watch customization or hasn't, for whatever reason, seen Cooper's lovely Talking Watches that you guys both did. Why don't you give people a little bit of background on what brought us to this kind of controversial but largely kind of accepted concept of, like, why isn't there more customizing happening in the watch world?
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised at how accepted it has been. Long story short, I came to Hodinkee about 2 years ago from Levi's. And at Levi's, customization is not just accepted, but encouraged. We had this phrase that your jeans were a blank canvas for personal expression. So the whole idea was, you know, rip them, cuff them, splatter them with paint, mm-hmm. you know, do whatever you can to make them your own. So when I arrived here at Hodinkee, I was really startled to see that that is not how things work in the watch world. And I kind of wondered why, and I wondered if I was the only one who thought that that was sort of strange and maybe even a little provincial. And I found this website for Cloister Watch Company, and it turned out that there was this guy in New York who I'd never met or heard of who was sort of quietly making these beautiful reinterpretations of vintage pieces. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, a lot of times I thought that they were improvements upon the originals. And so I just reached out to the guy who it turns out is Cooper Zelnick, who is our guest today, and introduced myself and began a relationship over 2 years ago. And finally now we've gotten in the room together and filmed this episode of Talking Watches.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the episode, and it kind of, you know, shone a light upon something in the watch world that I wasn't that aware of, this idea of kind of reimagining vintage watches, and especially vintage watches that aren't in, say, the top 10% of what everyone knows. Cooper, I'd love a little bit of an explanation, you know, the elevator pitch on how you went from loving watches to actually kind of reimagining them in some sense.
Sure. So first, thanks for having me. You know, for me, this started with just a love of vintage watches. So I was a collector. I started collecting when I was young. I became sort of not quite a vintage dealer, but someone who helped people find and buy and learn about and restore watches. And, you know, that was sort of a long story, but I ended up owning a Rolex 1601 Datejust that I hadn't intended to own. And I actually asked this question for myself, which was, you know, if I could turn this watch into something that was uniquely mine, something that I would want to wear every day, what would it look like and what would it be? And so the first Cloister vintage watch was built, you know, by me, for me. And, you know, pretty soon after, people started approaching me, people were excited about it. And we ended up embarking on this journey to create that same thing for others. And, you know, it's been the better part of 15 years and we're still doing it.
That's fascinating. So 15 years, how many watches over that time, if it's something that you share with people, how many watches have you sort of customized?
Very few, relatively speaking. I would say today we're on a clip of, you know, call it 25 to 50 a year. The first few years was probably less than 10 a year. So, mm-hmm. gosh, you know, a few hundred maybe. And they right. are all different.
And do you have a specific brands you prefer to work with, or it could be whatever a client is interested in?
We don't have any specific criteria in terms of brands. I like working with the brands that inspired me to fall in love with watches to begin with, right? So Rolex, Patek, Vacheron, probably a little less so on Audemars, Jaeger in a big way. And then we've done some work with Breitlings and others, but I'll admit I'm a little bit of a brand snob.
Well, it's an interesting thing to come at it from an admitted brand snob territory, which those brands certainly work for that. But to have the idea that you might want to change it, you know, we know the state of sort of watch customization, or at least I think most people have an idea of what's out there today. What was it like, 15 years ago when you started saying like, well, I could change that on the dial, or I could do this with the hands or something like that?
I'm tempted to say, and I think the answer you're looking for is it was much more taboo, right? Because there has been more acceptance of this in the last few years. But I think it's also true that 15 years ago, the mania around watch collecting, specifically vintage watch collecting, was much less intense.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of, well, you want a vintage Rolex, you're going to buy it on eBay. Maybe the dial's already refinished. Maybe it isn't. Maybe you don't know. I think that actually, like, at least from my perspective, and I'm trying to, you know, there was a degree to which I was inexperienced and naive, and a degree to which the sort of phenomenon around vintage collecting has really changed in the last decade and a half. Mm-hmm. But I think that I was probably doing something different, and the world was different in a way that it was fairly non-controversial then. But, you know, we weren't buying, you know, rare Pateks and changing them back then.
With that background, Nick, I'm curious if you could bring us up to speed on kind of what you learned when you wrote this story, which kind of confronted your experience in wanting to mod stuff. And although we don't have the video on for this recording, I'm wearing a modded Levi's shirt. It was modded by my bonfire at the cottage. burned because there's a nice hole in it, which I rather like now. It makes me think of the cottage, but I wore it in honor of this. What was your... I think we understand the thesis, but what did you kind of discover as you went? Because there are options out there. It just isn't... It's not like it is in other things, like, say, cars or homes or clothing, right?
I learned a couple things. The first is the extent to which customization is just the norm, not only in fashion. Like, forget about Levi's for a minute. You can customize your Tesla. You can customize your golf clubs from TaylorMade. Mm-hmm. You can customize just about everything. And watches seem to be this kind of funky outlier, you know, really clinging to the past, which watchers often do. And yet there seems to be, not only with Cooper, but also with the work that Bamford is doing, a movement toward greater acceptance. So Bamford, you know, started out modifying Rolexes, now is doing, they have sort of a watch customizer mm-hmm. online. That's a little more official than the Rolex stuff, where if you want a Zenith or Tag Heuer, and you want to change the stitching on the strap, you can, or the color of the hands, you can. And it's the first sort of large scale, almost an industrialized customization tool that I've seen used by right. the major watch brands. And I think it's going to be the standard eventually. It may not be anytime soon. I could be out of the industry by the time that happens, but it will eventually happen, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, I don't disagree on that front. I would say that the what strikes me is it's worth making some sort of a delineation between customization at say pre-purchase or at the time of purchase, like by the brand, and then something afterwards in the market, because I think those are going to be seen as two different things in a lot of different scope. You know, if you buy a car and modify it after, it may be worth more to you emotionally, but it might actually be worth less on its wheels. And I think that can sometimes be the same thing for watches. And the options, like you said, with Bamford are pretty good these days as far as being able to customize. Some brands like Omega have so many options that it almost feels like you're customizing them. You can pick between different dials and obviously lots of different iterations. And then you have a Bamford. I just got back from a week in Austria and Switzerland with Porsche Design, and they showed us the manufactory where they do their custom-made timepiece, which is a chronograph that literally uses a tool that looks and feels the same as what you would use to customize your Porsche. So you can get the same paint color on a ring on the watch. You can get the same leather, the exact same leather used on the strap. You can change the stitching color just like you can on the seats in the car. You can get a rotor, a winding mass that looks and is finished the same way as the wheels. And they had to build this technology, and it's something like 6 million combinations. Because, you know, if the little cap for the wheel that covers the lug nuts is the same, you can get all sorts of different versions for the what would cover, you know, the center of the winding mass. So the options out there are kind of interesting. But it's interesting to try and see the difference between, say, manufacturer customization and aftermarket modification. Because, Cooper, do you feel like those are still two pretty different worlds?
Well, I think they are. And I think it's worth maybe defining the terms here a little bit, right?
Sure.
When I think about, you know, customizing, we'll stick with the analogy about cars, right? There is the mm-hmm. Porsche configurator, which allows you to select yeah. from, you know, a meaningful number of preset options, but preset options. Then you have kind of the upper echelon, right? The true Porsche individual, whatever they call it. And that, you know, is done by the factory, and whether it's a PTS, paint a sample, or whether it's something else, you're now in this more rarefied world, but still a world created for you by Porsche. And there's incremental value there, at least as the market would describe value. But then let's say, for example, that I bought a, you know, Porsche 911 Turbo, and I didn't like the flat six in it. I wanted a V10. Now we're talking about a very different world. And when I think about custom watches, I tend to think about going above and beyond the manufacturer's intent rather than, you know, rather than availing oneself of all of the options that the manufacturer, you know, may give a customer. And I think like there are these moments, if you think about some of the work that Patek has done for like their most valued clients, right? Like some of the Michael Ovitz Pateks are really an interesting example. And then on the other side there, you know, if you imagine you were a French diver who had a Rolex Submariner and you sent it back to the factory for a service and it came back with a new dial and new hands, that's also a form of customization, although one that you wouldn't have had control over and may not have wanted. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of worlds converging here in a way that I think is really interesting.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point to me too, is that, you know, watches have a lot of tradition, and much of that tradition is still valuable, and some of it, in my view, you know, is beginning to seem obsolete. And the notion of having a piece unique made is for a lot of collectors the absolute
pick. Oh, it's the holy grail, right? It's the holy grail.
What is a piece unique if not a custom watch?
Right.
So, you know, the snake ends up eating its own tail a little bit when you get to the ultra, ultra, ultra high end.
Well, I mean, even look at Only Watch, right?
Only Watch is another great example. And then another point that I make in the article that I wrote is that Seikos, which are cheap and cheerful, no one cares if you modify those either, because, you know, it's only a few hundred bucks. They make a million of them. So who cares? So we've got the ultra high end, Only Watch, piece uniques, whatever. And we've got the low end. So everything's covered on those. So we're only really talking about the fat part of the bell curve where this is even an issue anymore. Mm-hmm. And I just think eventually that will start to erode.
And do you think it'll be an erosion of the general enthusiast mindshare being dedicated to originality over all else? Or will it be that everything else will be so commonplace? Like, let's talk about brands that make a million watches a year. That we'll all have experienced, or maybe not in person, but digitally have experienced all of these to the extent where we'll need a stronger hit.
I think the world ends up opening up and splitting a little bit, right? So I tend to spend my time thinking more about vintage than about modern. And I think there are categories within vintage. I think there will be universes of collectors and enthusiasts where there remains an appropriate focus on originality, right? And I sort of think about like the Patek 1518, which is a bit of a grail watch for me. There are very few of them. They're really special. I can't imagine anyone saying, and I'm pretty far out on this spectrum, I would never say, oh, you know, you want that, but you want it to have a oxblood dial. Let's do it. Like, I can't imagine that. But if you go into sort of, if you again go back into the car world, and I'm a BMW guy, you know, there are BMW enthusiasts who have like totally, totally mint 2002s or even 507s, right? And then you have the modder community. And And within the modder community, there's this real joy around what you can do to these cars. And I would observe that the two groups have respect and reverence for one another. And I think that emerges, right? I think that we get to a place of, if you see a beautifully customized watch, even if you are a purist, which I am, you can sort of really appreciate the artistry of that and really appreciate the uniqueness of that without asking the question of, oh, that's a special dial. Was that put on by Patek or was that put on by someone else? Right.
Right. And if I add in one more wrinkle, I'd say if we take that perspective, which I don't disagree with, especially when it comes to something like BMW, which is a great option, that's another one of these companies, manufacturers, that there's a whole cottage industry, very successful cottage industry of people who are ready to modify that vehicle when you're ready, whether it's...
And they get subsumed, right? Like if you think about AMG and Mercedes, if you AMG, think about absolutely. Alpina and BMW, they actually ultimately get subsumed, which is sort of fascinating in and of itself.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good comparison. But on the new side, I wonder how much modification or customization is being held back by this general vibe of maintaining, preserving the value of this thing, of this asset, rather than it just being a watch that you wear and enjoy. I do wonder if it's something that would be hard for the current enthusiast community, the core that you know is watching what a watch is worth or trying to buy at the right time. That sort of, and then the idea of changing it almost seems antithetical to the mode. It's not really how I interface with watches, but I definitely saw it come up in the comments.
Yeah, I think Cooper and I both agree on this, that if you're going to resell your watch, you should not customize it. I mean, that's
for sure.
Like that's a terrible idea. And also, you know, some of the comments were sort of like, well, you can't trust like Jimmy down the block to have good taste. And it's like, well, that's Jimmy's problem. You know, like Jimmy should still be able to exercise poor taste in all kinds of ways. It, you know, you can't legislate taste. But the resale market is, I think, definitely what's holding this back, because these things are expensive to begin with. They can grow in value. And one way to guarantee that your watch will lose value, unless you are Karl Lagerfeld or someone for whom provenance is important, is to start messing with it.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not the kind of collector who's anticipating some massive estate sale. So who cares? I wear them for me and that's it.
Yeah. And it is funny, right? Like, because on the new stuff, the place that I go is if the brands also have a strong vested interest in not allowing this, right? If you think about the buzz mm-hmm. that Patek was able to generate this year with that new collection of Salmon Dial watches, like, you could have made some pretty interesting Salmon Dial watches last year, right? Or if you think about like the Patek 5168, that sort of khaki green Aquanaut, mm-hmm. fascinating watch, too big for my wrist, right? Like that, you know, a 5065 with that dial would have been amazing, right? But like the brands want to control releases. And while there is real meaningful technical advancement occurring, there's also a lot of like aesthetic control and a lot of novelty related to aesthetic, right? If 2022 also is a year of the green dial, right? Like that there's a lot of that going on in a way that's important. But I agree too. I think like I have watches that if I were designing them, I would design them differently. And even though I am a customizer, I would not customize. I have stuff that's beautiful in its imperfection. And I really, really try to see both sides of that.
Right. And then where do you think the brands really come into this? Because obviously it's disruptive if someone can get what they want from somebody else, even if it's based on, say, the original product. And then there's also this concept, and you do see this in the car game, this concept of brands wanting to protect their position in the market, their sort of their vibe, their ethos, if you will. I've talked to Nick in the past about Deadmau5's Ferrari, which is, you know, a highly customized
yes.
Ferrari that he had made. And of course, like Ferrari notoriously loves a cease and desist and does so for, I think, a number of reasons. Obviously, if it's an IP thing, you have to protect your IP or you can lose it. But they didn't like a number of things about this car. And of course, the car, after it kind of showed up and made a bit of a splash, went away. Whereas other brands seem to be more open to the idea that somebody would, you know, put a lot of personality into the vehicle, especially if that personality kind of matches with a certain level of car culture. And I just wonder if the watch thing, especially the deep enthusiasm for watches in an online sense and a shareable online sense, just isn't mature enough yet to kind of accept yet another layer of this enthusiasm.
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, I think the brands are going to be very hesitant to embrace this sort of thing. If you think mm-hmm. about the aftermarket sales that are going on, especially with the hype watches, right? The Aquanaut, the Nautilus, the Royal Oak, and some of the Sport Rolex stuff. The brands could do any number of things differently, which they're not doing because they're focused on preserving a certain relationship with customers, a certain brand ethos, a certain feel. So I think the brands are going to be very, very slow to accept any level of customization. As a person who has been on Instagram, I would observe that like there's a lot of interest in customization. There's a lot of interest in the art of the possible. And I'm really excited about that. And, you know, like I fear we're making this a car podcast rather than a watch podcast, but
yeah,
the counterexample to the Ferrari is the Singer Porsche, sure. right? Where like Singer has gone back in time. They have a better idea about what to do with a 964 than Porsche arguably did, definitely does. And they've built something spectacular. I think that's only helped Porsche's brand. I think that's like not unrelated to the release of the Sport Classic and the new Speedster and all of these like throwback analog Porsches that are being made. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good for everyone. So like, I would argue that you know, this ethos of like really enthusiast collector customer driven design can totally coexist with like the stewardship of these brands and the totally reasonable desire to push these ideas and brands into the future. And I'd love to see those things coexist.
To take it to a place that's different from cars, but I think equally relevant. I think about music and I think about the
remixes and covers.
Exactly. I think about remix culture, mashup culture. I mean, pretty much all of hip hop. I also think about technology like Photoshop.
Sure.
Yeah. I think about widely available software that allows people to manipulate sound files and image files, and people who have grown up knowing nothing else expect to be able to remix everything.
Okay, it's time for our ad break. And anyone who has ever bought themselves a nice watch and then tried to add it to an insurance policy will know just how big a hassle it can be to get your watch insured. You need receipts, an appraisal, a pile of photos, and lots of patience just to get your watch properly protected. Frankly, it sucks, so we decided to make something better. Hodinkee Insurance is the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance. You know, I don't want to spend too much time, or I don't want to spend the entire show talking about, you know, the idea of modifying a Rolex and what your options are. It came up in the comments that you can even, it's up to Rolex, but there's options from the service center to actually change things about the watch. Once they're a certain age and whatever might be available in terms of parts that fit, there are opportunities there. So it's funny that they don't make it more popular or something, you know, more direct. And of course, I do wonder how much of this is because they're not selling watches direct to people all the time or most of the time. You know, they have to work through an AD. So that there is always this layer between the customer and the final brand. And I think that happens both on, say, Seiko side and all the way up to Rolex or above. And that kind of means that, yeah, on one end, you might be modding a Seiko because you just wanted a slightly different handset, or you wanted something wild that doesn't even say Seiko on the dial anymore. But on the other side, at the top end, do you think this pushes people into the indie space where they might get to speak with the person who's creating the watch, get to change a detail or two, make a choice about dial color, that kind of stuff?
I mean, I really hope so, right? Like the thing that I've tried to do and that I think is the best of customization is this democratization of it, right? This idea that you don't have to be the world's best customer of mm-hmm. Patek to get a piece unique. And I think like the small brands and the independents probably afford that opportunity much more easily than some of the larger houses do. So I really hope so. And I don't know, I think that there's something happening here. There's a broader historical context, right, where people are tiring of mass luxury. And, you know, I get made fun of by my friends, unsurprisingly, because I am obsessed with custom in every aspect of my life. Like, I make I have custom clothes made. I like having custom furniture made. I'm I am way out on the edge. And I think it's wonderful. I think that like this individual expression is really great. And in a world where, you know, in 1965, I think wearing a Rolex Day-Date was a status symbol, right? There was a reason that Marilyn Monroe gave that watch to JFK. That would have been slightly before 65, obviously. But today that isn't the case anymore. And I think that there's this question of taste and a question of status, and they shouldn't be merged. But like the idea that you can really, really express yourself through a thing is wonderful. And yes, for sure, I think people are realizing that if you want to do that, you have to move away from some of the most established tastemakers of the last generation.
And when that happens, that's when I think the big brands will get on board. You know, at the moment, there's absolutely no incentive for them to. My dream is to be able to walk into, let's just say, a Rolex AD. I have a Day-Date 1803, which I cherish. I'm wearing it right now, and
those are the best.
I would never want to compromise the aesthetic of the case or the dial. It's perfect. But if I wanted the date wheel to be in Spanish, I'd love to be able to stroll into an AD and say, hey, can you pop this date wheel out and put a Spanish one in and just walk right back out? Like, that would be amazing. But why would they do that?
And not feel dirty, right?
Yeah.
And not feel gross.
But that, you know, at the moment, there's no incentive for them to do it. When the sea change that Cooper's talking about ultimately happens, and it will, that's when the rest of this comes along too.
The thing that strikes me is I figure a lot of brands will eventually lean on this, or at least some level of personalization, because it makes the product so much more sticky. Like, Cooper, do you find a lot of your watches get sold, you know, shortly after you modify them?
Never. We've never had anything get sold. And I'll give you a great example, because what you're saying reminds me of it. So someone emailed me today and said, hey, when my dad died, I inherited his two-tone 1601. Mm-hmm. I loved my dad. The watch is meaningful. The watch is ugly, and I don't wear it. I've tried everything, right? Like, I've switched the bracelet. I've like tried any number of straps, but I just don't wear the watch and I want to, right? So yes, for sure. Like, you'd assume the brands would want people to keep these and pass them down. I'm thinking of like the old Patek advertisement on this topic.
Exactly.
But also, like, I think that's what people want, right? And yes, there's temptation, right? If you're lucky enough to get one of a couple watches, and we all know what they are at retail, there's a temptation to flip them. But I think people want to own these things and develop a relationship with them. And I definitely see customization as a way to deepen that relationship, or in certain cases, to create that relationship for the first time with an old thing, which is really powerful.
One of the things Cooper said in our Talking Watches that I really liked was that his whole goal is just to get watches out of the safe and onto the wrist. And if customizing that piece is going to help that guy start wearing his dad's Rolex, then great. Like, do it immediately.
Yeah.
You know, to me, watches and safes are just kind of sad. I totally get that they're an alternative asset class and all of that, but man, there's just no romance in that at all. And as we said before, if that is why you're in the game, like, that should be allowed too.
Fine,
like,
of great. Course.
Put them in the safe, make your money. But for those of us who presume that the reason we're in the game is to wear them, if there's a reason you're not wearing it that can be adjusted, like, go ahead and adjust it.
But it's funny, because these days, most brands don't even leave space for an engraving.
Right.
Right? And I feel like that was kind of a known thing for a long time. You'd have some space on the case back. You could have it engraved. And I think that immediately makes a watch a lot harder to see as, you know, cash in a different form.
Right. Yeah, it does. And I think that paradoxically, right, as the brands have become much more focused on not allowing their customers to flip these watches, there's also been this trend where the watches are much more flippable, and where flipping is more lucrative than it ever has been before. So there's this weird tension there. And I think some of this stuff goes back to the early days of collecting too, frankly.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point. And it is true that as watches and watch enthusiasm has modernized, they've become much easier to move. There's both substructures within which you can sell them. Of course, Crown and Caliber being an obvious one that we should mention. The Hood and Key Shop also being an obvious one that we can mention. And within that, it's much easier these days to tell if you have a real or a fake watch. Paperwork, serial numbers, all that kind of stuff is much more modernized. You have Vacheron using the blockchain for some of this stuff. Like, there's all these moves that make it something that can be moved around, and yet they seem to want it less than ever. And I do feel like some level of customization, of personalization, even I think that mostly what we're talking about here is pre or at point of sale versus changing things after. But my experience with modding watches is on the Seiko side. I have one Rolex. I'm not changing it. I love it the way it is. And largely I bought it because I love that design. But I've had lots of Seikos that were just a little bit off. I wanted a different hand color. I wanted to change the bezel. And I think that world offers an unbelievable amount of fun with very little risk.
Right.
Do you do that work yourself, James?
I haven't done it myself. I have a friend who's going to teach me, hopefully over the fall, winter, more time inside this year. I'd like to learn how to do that. And there's some great guides online for that. But in the past, I've done the bezel. That's easy. So yes, I've done the bezels. But when it came to hands or stuff where you had to remove the movement from the case, I let a friend, someone more qualified than myself, handle it. But it's fascinating. And I follow a little bit of the Seiko thing where, you know, Reddit has an incredible Seiko modding community. And there is a point where I think Seiko's come and talked to people about their Instagram presence and said, like, hey, please don't use our name. These aren't our watches anymore. And like, I guess it kind of begs, if you want to get into the philosophy of the whole like ship of Theseus thing, but I think it also proves that it's just way more fun to have more options and to be able to make something like this yours. And maybe the fun is easier to understand when the watch is $500 or $1,000, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I have a Rocketa. I bought on Etsy for $110, and it's technically a Franken watch because it has a different handset. But you know, at the $110 price point, I think I literally got what I paid for there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, it's not as though that's any kind of resale asset. So at a certain level, who cares? You know, it's originality only really matters if you're like keeping score at home for your own pleasure, which some people, I guess, do, or if you intend to try to unload that watch at some point and need to testify to its original.
Right.
Otherwise, who cares?
But it's hard to balance the keep score or value the type of emotion that would lead someone to loving being able to modify their watch versus loving the original, right? We see that in cars, right? Guys that has to be original paint, has to be, you know, new old stock, has to be this or that. And then on the other side, you see a ton of people who get it. You know, I don't think I owned my Jeep for the 10 straight days before I changed something. It was like part of what I knew I was getting into.
Right. Well, let me offer a thought experiment. So I think the majority of serious collectors today, if you said, I'm going to give you the opportunity to modify your watch in an aftermarket way, they would recoil. But I think if you said, I'm going to give you the opportunity to work with your favorite brand and have them design you a piece unique, I think 100 people out of 100 would take them up on that. And then if you added the wrinkle and said, you can work with your favorite brand, you can design a piece unique, but you can never resell it, right? Then I think 100 out of 100 people would still jump at the opportunity to do that, right? So there's this question of like, there is a question of pure taboo, even beyond a question of value, that that's really interesting here.
Then the question, Cooper, becomes like, well, who are you to modify their stuff? You know, what are your bona fides? It might be helpful for people listening to this to sort of understand kind of like why you think you're qualified to be messing with their Vacherons, you know?
Yeah. And I guess my answer is, if you think I am, then I am. And if you think I'm not, then I'm definitely not, right? But like my view of this is that anyone is qualified to mess with their own Vacheron. And when I think about my work, I don't think, hi, I'm Cooper, I can make a better Vacheron. I think, hi, I'm Cooper, I can help you make a watch that's more you, whether that's a Vacheron or anything else. And I really try to take a very light touch and help the people whose watches these are kind of channel their individuality. And to the extent that we're really good at something, it's not, you know, painting watch dials, it's helping people create things for themselves. That's how I would describe our work.
Yeah, I definitely get that. And I watched the talking watches, and I would say that the modifications that were on display there were, you know, fairly low key. definitely felt like something that could have been done in period, maybe when you've got something like a dial signature or initials or something, maybe that was for a great client, that sort of thing. It all felt within tone. Do you guys get in, does Cloister, when I say you guys, do you get into things that are a little bit more wild than that? Do you take it further?
We have at times, right? We've done metalworking. We've done sapphire case backs where they didn't exist. We have done in the past a little bit of, PVD or DLC, things like that, although we don't do much of it anymore. But I think, quite frankly, like, we are not interested as a design studio in everything that can be done. And we're certainly not interested in doing things because they can be done. We try to be low-key. And, I think there are, again, great examples of, like, the boundaries of watchmaking being pushed, right? If you think about the McEnroe Lefty Submariner, right? That's really so cool. That's just really cool. So, and that's a technical feat, right? Like, and also what Artisans de Genève is doing, just, you know, exposing these movements, changing parts, like, that's technically complex and wonderful. You know, when I think about our work, we are really trying to put ourselves in the mindset of the factory in the period of time when the watch was made. And to ask the question I think you just asked, which is, well, what if the person was the world's best Vacheron client? Or what if the person was an amazing Jaeger client and personal friends with the designer? What could you have done then, right? We want it to be characteristic.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And you know, I don't want to get to the end of this and say, like, oh, it looks like the lesson learned was the friends we made along the way. But like, it largely comes down to, like, what do you love about watches? What gets you excited about watches? If it's preserving their originality and caring for them like fine, very important baseball cards or something like that, and keeping them in this very specific space and occasionally bringing them out to kind of appreciate them, I think that's good and fine. But I don't think it's any more good or more fine than wanting to change it and you know, following your emotion through that path.
Yeah, that's perfectly said, James. And my whole vision of watches, and even you might say for Hodinkee, is a place where all things are possible, you know, and trying to unwind a lot of the rules that the watch industry and community have made for themselves, that are not preordained, you know, from on high,
mm-hmm.
and where it's all fine. Like, I'm not a huge fan of diamond bust downs, but like, it's your money. If you want to do that, great. I just don't love the notion of anyone telling anyone else what they can and can't do with their money or their watches. That's when it starts to bum me out. I mean, there are plenty of watches I would never customize, and plenty of customizations that are ugly. Like, customization is not inherently a great thing. The ability and freedom to customize is inherently a good thing.
Right. I'd also say there's a lot of watches that come right out of the factory that don't need any help being ugly.
Totally. they're ugly all on their own.
I agree. I have a 1991 E34 BMW M5 that I have customized in what I think is a tasteful way. So I've done a coilover kit. I've done a spectacular interior. I've chipped it. I've done some tuning. It is an M5, and it's from the period, but it's, to my mind, better. And I drive it, right? I have 120,000 miles on the car. I recently drove it to JFK. And if you're a New Yorker and you've ever tried to pick someone up at the airport, you have to pretend your car is broken so they don't make you move. So I pop the hood open to pretend it's broken. And I see this sticker from 1991 that says, "Do not put any aftermarket parts on this car. It'll void the warranty." And I found myself laughing at this, right? Because the truth is, if I hadn't modified this BMW, I would not be driving it to JFK. Maybe I'd take it out on a Sunday. Maybe I'd use it a little bit. But I've tuned and updated and changed the car so that I can use it and love it and enjoy it. So, like, my opinion on watchmaking is, if this gets a watch onto your wrist, if it makes you smile, if it's awesome as you define awesome, it's all good.
Yeah, I like it. I think that's a great example. I love the idea that by modding the watch, not only do you make it more yours, but you also remove some of the baggage that might be attached to it. And it just becomes something you get to use however you see fit. And you definitely see people do that with cars. And I don't know that, I can't imagine many things that would make an E34 M5 very tasteless. That's quite a car. You know, I did to close out a little challenge. I think is in order. I would love to hear from you both an idea of a watch that you love that you think is only one, maybe two changes away from being something you would immediately go out and grab, whether that was something you would do yourself or theoretically, let's say you could just go to the website, you know, change this color or this text or whatever, and then order it. Is there anything that's that close where that one little change could make the difference?
I can think of one and it's total blasphemy, but I love the idea of a Royal Oak on a leather strap.
Okay.
I realize that the whole point of the Royal Oak is the integrated bracelet, and that for a lot of people, including Ben Clymer, the bracelet is as important as the case, as important as that eight-sided bezel. It's a lot of the show is in the bracelet. Like, respect for that point of view. But I'm a strap guy. I love the idea of that shape, especially an old one. If I could get one that's a little smaller and wear it as a dress watch on a leather strap rather than as a sport watch on a steel bracelet, like, count me in for that.
When did they start offering them on leather straps? Not that long, like when they were smaller?
Last 10 or 15 years for men.
I also can't remember if they, Cooper, how many would they of normal time only Royal O's would they have done in with leather? Because I know the more complicated ones sometimes had leather, and obviously they had other straps for the offshore.
I'm thinking, I used to work for a guy who had an amazing time only, well, it had a date complication Royal Oak on that. It was yellow gold with the black alligator strap, and it was pretty. But it's funny, Nick, you're preaching to the choir. I have a few Royal Oaks, and my first one, I recently had a custom made Hermes style double loop strap put on it. And for me, the first Royal Oak I owned was the 39 millimeter chrono from 2011. And it's just too thick for my wrist. And by putting it on a strap, I've slimmed the profile of the watch and I wear it again. So I am totally in support of your mission there.
Yeah, it's not an impossibility, you know, but I definitely don't remember them making, I could be dead wrong on it, but Nick, yeah, I don't remember them making the smaller, older ones on anything other than the bracelet.
No.
And I've seen some of them. I want to say it was a dual time from maybe 10 years ago that was on an alligator leather strap that, you know, had the integrated click-in feature for the lugs and all that. And it was pretty cool.
I love the Royal Oak. Oh man, that blue dial dual time is awesome.
Yeah, they're fun watching. I have to admit, I'm a sucker for the way the bracelet fits. But I think if I had a Royal Oak, if I was that fortunate to have one, I would get to a point where I'd go like, well, I'd like the leather option too. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, look what VC does with the Overseas. They come with all three.
Mm-hmm.
They know people want to swap them.
Yeah.
Cooper, anything on your list? Let's call it a small sort of change that would really change the appeal of a watch?
Yes.
This might be something you do all the time. You just got like a huge folder of Photoshops or something like that.
I do. But I'm actually, so I'll blaspheme a little bit too. I'm on vacation right now and I'm wearing a Patek Aquanaut 5065. I love it. I thought the 5060 was a little small. I think this watch introduced in 98 is awesome. I think it's a piece of history. I probably would never change mine. But here's the problem. If you compare the 5065 to the 5167, you note that there's not enough real estate on the 5065 because they have these weird minute tick marks that are funny and misaligned. And then they have the sort of larger loom plots. And then within those, they have the numerals. And to me, it actually makes the watch look too small and it looks funny. So, you know, what I would do probably is get rid of the loom plots and then move the numerals outward. So you have a little bit more real estate for that kind of grenade style on the dial. You have a little bit more balance. And if you think about what they did on the 5167, there is more real estate in the center of the dial and the numerals are larger. So it emphasizes them relative to the loom plots, which they just, I think, got wrong on this watch in 98. As an aside, I might delete the date window too, but that's my own personal that's my own personal vendetta there.
Yeah, get rid of it. Get it out of here.
Right? And if you think about that watch too, there are these weird minute marks that actually make the date window look like it's not a rectangle in this really ugly way. It is a rectangle, but it doesn't look like one. And there's this screwed up visual illusion that happens. And every time I look at the watch, I think that has to have been a mistake. And by the way, that's probably the strongest argument both for and against customizing, right? Yes, I should be able to correct what I perceive to be a mistake. And also, it's kind of wonderful that I get to see what I perceive to be a mistake on an iconic watch. And I don't know what the answer is, but I was thinking about it this morning when I put on the watch.
Yeah, I got two thoughts on the 5065 because I just wrote a story about the, you know, the kind of birth of this range of watches for when we did 90s week, and the date position relative to the minute markers is one problem. The thing that bugged me more is that it's just ever so slightly cuts into the grenade part of the dial.
It does. It's totally screwed up. It's too wide.
I feel like it didn't have to happen. That's just they made that adjustment for the circumference of the date wheel.
They must have. And it doesn't make any sense.
And then just recently, I went and shot Rare Shades, this Porsche show. They did one in Toronto. And I met one of the many people I shot wrist shots with had a 5065. And I was chatting with him about it. And I couldn't quite realize what was different about it. And then he was like, oh, if people bring it up in the comments, I brushed the bracelet on purpose. So the bracelet for the 5065 is all polished.
Yeah.
Which I think, to his credit, it looked really good brushed.
Yeah. Yeah. The bezel's brushed. Arguably, the bracelet should be brushed, right?
I mean, you can go either way for sure. For me, a fully polished bracelet on a sport watch is an interesting move, not unlike the date placement. Mine is one that I think I've probably harped on enough. But if I could go online and buy a modern Seamaster 300M, the white dial with the black bezel on a rubber strap, and if I could simply swap out the skeleton hands for the sword hands they used on the 2254 in previous, kind of that MOD look, I would have owned one of those watches when they first started making them. I've owned a 2254, and it was one of my favorite things was the sword hands. You get more loom. I love that sort of mid-century, like I said, MOD look, and I do think that if we ever get to that point with Omega where you could pick the watch and then say skeleton, you know, Bond style hands or the sword hands, I think that would be enough to push me over the edge for sure. Cause it, I mean, it's a great watch as is. I don't dislike the skeleton hands to an extreme extent, but I would really like the sword hands.
I'm with you. I think that I'm totally sold on that.
I think we got three good watch ideas here.
Cooper, thanks for doing the show, and thanks for doing Talking Watches too, and wishing you all the best with Cloyster. I think for a certain collector with a certain point of view, it's a really cool option to have, and I'm just glad that you're out there doing your work.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for including me, and thanks for talking about this topic.
Yeah, we don't have to take up any more of your vacation. We really appreciate you coming on, and it was a really fascinating chat. I think that counts as a show. And if you're listening and you enjoyed it, you know what I ask, please share it with a friend. Please leave us a comment. And if you have an idea of a watch mod or a thought about watch mods and customization and otherwise, hit the show notes for this episode on hodinkee.com and leave us a comment. I'd love to continue the conversation and maybe even do another episode on in the future. Maybe not when Cooper's on vacation. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.